We've got a very interesting question for the panel, and it comes from Colleen McLaughlin of Birdwatch Ireland, a colleague of Niall Hatch. So let's say hello to Colleen now. Hello, Colleen.
Yes, hello, Derek. Yeah.
Lovely to speak with you. So give the listener a little bit of background. Tell us about yourself.
Well, I like to describe myself as a naturalist, but and an ecologist and a conservationist. But in reality, I've just been producing magazines for environmental NGOs for all my working life. So I'm really a magazine producer, I suppose, editor, sub-editor, designer. I do all that. So, yes, I've been doing Wings magazine for actually 30 years now.
Oh, my goodness.
With Niall Hatch for about 15 years, but I was doing it for long before that. I do the Mountaineering Ireland quarterly magazine as well. I produce that, and I do a quarterly magazine for the Native Woodland Trust, which is a much smaller organisation, but I'm very interested in trees myself. And finally, I do the magazine called Flukes for the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. It's produced twice a year, roughly, you know, but they get an awful lot into each issue. So that's basically what I do. I do other bits and bobs, but that's really my core jobs.
Well, you must be used to getting lots of questions.
Yeah, yeah.
But today you have a question for us. So off you go.
Okay, well, just like to give three examples which brought me to this question. You know, about 4 years ago, my eldest brother, Eamon, was moving from a house in Garrick and Shore, and he was moving to Wexford. And he knew that the site would be developed in Garrick and Shore, and he was aware of a rare plant that was growing wild in the garden. It's called vervain, and it's very rare in Ireland, but it's not so rare in England. And he brought me up a sample of it to put in my garden, hoping that maybe I would be able to keep it going, as it were. But it actually died. The habitat wasn't right for it in my garden. But the funny thing is that a year went by, and then myself and Eamon were over in England looking for rare local species like Dartford Warbler, Woodlark, and Cyril Bunting, of course, yeah. And we saw them all okay. But we were parked at a nature reserve, and when I got out of the car, I just noticed these plants growing along the edge of the road. And I said to Eamon, that's vervain. And I'd only ever seen it once before, the sample that he brought me, but I instantly recognised it as vervain. It's quite a lot commoner in southern England compared to Ireland. So I was amazed that I was able to remember it, considering that I'd only ever seen it once. So I'd like to just give two more examples. Is that okay?
Absolutely. And you might describe what it looks like too, please.
Well, vervain is actually just a thin, stringy little flower. It's nothing special at all. It's very thin, quite stringy, tiny little flowers. It's not like what you'd call a beautiful wildflower, although most wildflowers are beautiful. There's nothing particularly interesting about it. It just looks different. But then anyway, I was on a nature walk with the Native Woodland Trust this summer, and somebody said, Colleen, what's that flower there? And I said, that's Black Medic, which is a flower in the clover family, small flower. And then I was wondering afterwards, gosh, now how do I know for sure that that's Black Medic? So I took a photograph of it and I checked it out, and I found out, yes, it was Black Medic. Okay. And one of the things about the Black Medic is that the leaflet, the main leaflet, has a tiny little spike on it. And I was just wondering, what on earth would that be for, you know? So anyway, the third example was more recently yet again. I was walking on the West Pier. I frequently walk there, and I noticed this flower. It's in the mustard family. This one, it's called hedge mustard. Again, it's not a flower that you would regard as a beautiful flower. It's quite ordinary, but it has a distinctive shape. So I can recognize it immediately when I see it. And that's when it occurred to me to ask the question, why do wildflowers have such a distinctive look that we humans, you know, can instantly recognize them? And yet the flowers themselves, because they have no eyes, they can't recognize each other. So this is the strange thought that I had, sort of thinking outside the box. And I was trying to think what it could possibly be. So I have a few ideas myself, but maybe your panellists would like to get in, or what do you think?
I think that's a very good idea. Let's start with Matthew Jebb. Matthew.
Well, I think this is a fantastic question, and it really underlines our interactions with the natural world, that of course we can recognise different things, but not because they want to be recognised. It's a human excitement of categorising things. It is important for us because we want to be able to talk about a plant like the vervain. You're talking about a plant there, you tell us the name, and suddenly all of us are aware of what you're talking about, in the same way that we might talk about different breeds of dog or sheep, cattle. Straight away, it brings the image up for others around us. Now, I think some of that examples you've just given us are great because they do demonstrate how easy it is to tell things apart. And in the bird world, for example, we're aware of things like chiff-chaff, willow warbler, almost identical looking birds, but their song is different. And in the mammal world, we have this wonderful example about 20 years ago, when suddenly European mammalogists became aware that there were two kinds of pipistrelle bats. Prior to that, everyone had lumped them together. And it's only when these bat detectors came along, we realized that there were actually some bats speaking in a much higher, you know, tone. So they were called soprano bats. And the other little pipistrelle was left as a pipistrelle bat. So it segregated these things on something different. So, you know, what you're saying there, Colleen, is, yeah, you can look at two plants, tell them apart. And the question is, why is that? And I would sort of counter that by saying, well, when we come to grasses, sedges and rushes, actually they all look horribly similar to people who are not familiar with plants. And when they're not actually in bloom or carrying fruits, they can be extremely hard to tell apart. You've really got to have a tremendous amount of experience to distinguish the different species. So some species are very hard to tell apart until their defining characteristic. It might be the flower appears, or we hear their song, or their speech in the case of the pipistrelle bat, and suddenly we realise that we are actually looking at two different species, but they looked so similar. In a sense, we often refer to them as cryptic species. They're hidden until we know what to look for.
I have several opinions on this matter as well. But the first opinion is, Colleen, what do you mean calling flowers beautiful and not beautiful? I mean, you said the poor old mustard wasn't much good and you didn't even say what colour the vervain was. That's not fair to be saying they're beautiful. Do flowers have to be beautiful? I mean, is that what their job in life is? I mean, the reason why they have flowers is their reproductive part, and that's where your pollen and the pollen in the flowers is brought by insects from one to another. So the insects have to know where they're going. There's no point in going from a daisy to a hedge moss to the pollen won't be any good. So they look the same so that they can be pollinated and they come out at the same time. And in fact, there's been work been done on how an insect knows whether or not the nectar has been taken from the flower. There's different charges in that, so a bee isn't wasting its time going into a flower for nectar or for pollen when it's already been taken away. So there's a huge sophistication in the flowers, whether they look nice or not. I mean, the ones that Matthew is speaking of, the grasses and the sedges, they're wind pollinated, so they just let it all hang out and it's blown off in the wind. So there's no the wind has no eyes and doesn't see what it's doing, but the insects most certainly do.
That was one of my thoughts, that you know, it's handy for flowers to have a distinct identity, because then when they're in flower, the pollinators will go to one. If they find honey nectar there, then they will look for other samples of the same species. So that was one of the reasons I thought that they do have this distinct identity. But could I just quickly go back to what you were saying there about wildflowers and their beauty and stuff? I had another point that I was going to make, is that I think that most wildflowers are beautiful, you know, like the ones that I'm not talking about now, the really, really hard to identify grasses and stuff. I'm talking about your general wildflower that you see out in the countryside, there are very few that you could say are not beautiful. Do you remember I was saying that, you know, you can tell flowers instantly by their shape or their structure and features like that. But I was wondering, so why are they beautiful? And I thought, what possible reason could there be for that? And I was thinking, maybe it's not that the flowers are beautiful. Maybe they have ended up looking beautiful, but that it's only us humans who see them as beautiful because we are programmed to identify them, you know, for our own benefit, you know, so that we recognize them and take an interest in them. Because when we were hunter-gatherers, we would go out looking for specific plants to gather. And so maybe over the years that we started to see that plants were beautiful, you know, because that's just our perception of what beauty is. So that was another idea that I had. What do you think of that? Anyone?
Well, gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Old time he is a-flying. Now, what is a display all about? It's usually about getting a suitable sexual partner in order to transfer your genes onto the next upper, in the next generation. Now, it seems to me, I'm trying to put myself in the place of a plant. If I were a chiffchaff or a willow warbler that Matthew mentioned, it would be straightforward. I would broadcast the chiffchaff song and a mate hopefully would show up because it recognises the song. Now, if I'm a bird or if I'm a flower, then it's rather more subtle now. Suppose I'm a foxglove. Well, I want to attract pollinators in so that they will take my pollen to the next flower. That is what the primary thing is, to identify myself as a foxglove or whatever I am. But there's a higher order here. I don't want any old bumblebee to come in. I want it to carry the nectar to my own kind, or the pollen to my own kind of flower. I don't want the bumblebee hopping from flower to flower and wasting all my valuable nectar and pollen where it's not going to produce anything. I want it to go from me, a digitalis, a foxglove, to another foxglove. That's the first order. Then I will be able to promulgate my genes. But there's a higher order here. How do I ensure that the bumblebee goes to a well-endowed other plant? If I were a bird, I wouldn't accept any old lady that comes on shore. I'd assess whether she's up to it or not, or whether she's attractive or not, because I want to get my genes attached to somebody very, very glamorous and strong.
Now, hold on to your horses there. I thought the females are the ones that select the males. Yes. When it comes to the birds.
Yes.
Because that's why the males sing.
That's why the males sing. And the females have an even bigger problem, because they have to be absolutely sure that whoever fertilises their egg is the best man around, because once they're fertilised, that's that, and she'll be saddled with them until they hatch and fledge and so on and forth. Now, if I'm a flower, I want to get my pollen to a well-endowed flower. Not just, first of all, to get to a flower of my own species, but secondly, to get to a flower that's well endowed, that's a good guarantee. Now, is there any mechanism within flowers? Maybe Matthew would have this. I know that bumblebees go right down to the bottom of the digitalis bulb. They go right down to the end of, that's where the nectar is. So they will be looking out for similarly well endowed ones. And if the bee that gets down there is a good bee, and he's going to look for another good digitalis to dump that pollen in. Is there a mechanism for assessing the merits of other flowers through the bees or through the pollinators? Is there some way by which I can ensure I get my genes not only to my own kind, but to a well-endowed member of my own kind?
I think the answer to that, Richard, is that what Charles Darwin spotted was that different flowers attract different pollinators. And that was one of his sort of breakthrough abilities to interpret the natural world. So he saw, for example, that a honeysuckle smells beautifully fragrant at night, and it's got a star-shaped white flower that moths visited. So it was, in fact, moth pollination has this syndrome of all sorts of characteristics. And likewise, he realised he could predict, when you looked at a flower, he could say that flower is pollinated by butterflies or by birds or by bees or by flies. And it was an incredible step forwards. So what Colleen is saying there in looking at a vervain and a hedge mustard, he has seen the same thing that might attract a pollinator. So I think that's a very good observation, that it might not just be the flower, it's the whole sort of gestalt, the whole sort of look of the plant that brings the bee in. And we know for a fact, with the foxglove, that when the bumblebee arrives, she always visits the lowermost flower and she works her way up the inflorescence all the way to the top flower just before there's only a bud, so to speak. And that direction of travel is very important because she's bringing pollen to the lowermost flowers, which when we look at them, we realise they've got their little stigmas open. So they're acting as female plants or female flowers receiving pollen. But as she works her way up, the stigmas are closed and instead the anthers are releasing pollen. So before she leaves that plant, she is given a dose of the local pollen to take on to the next plant. So it's a wonderful insight that the foxglove plant is ensuring that pollen is shared between plants and not self-pollinating the thing. And that is the most important thing a plant can do, is make sure it gets its pollen from one plant to another. And insect vectors are just the perfect go-between, if you like, for that process.
Is it like vintage wine? Suppose I'm producing nectar and I want a certain kind of insect to come and take my pollen. Can I develop a taste in my nectar that will keep the riffraff out and only get the ones I want in? I give them a taste for this vintage. Is there any element of that? And you haven't addressed my quality control problem. How do I ensure that I get my pollen to the right members of my own species and not the ones that are second rate?
I think that the answer is what Darwin spotted was anomalies in the animal world, which he referred to as sexual selection, whereby, you know, the best looking bird of paradise or the rhinoceros beetle with the big sort of antlers on its head, they were the ones that won the females. So the red stag, the red deer, the stags in the autumn, they fight for little harems of does that they are going to mate with. And that form of selection, he could see, was very distinct. So we get this sexual selection in animal species, but I don't think anybody has been able to claim this of the plant world, because standing alone as a different plant that is more attractive to a bee than anything else actually means that you won't be able to spread your pollen, because all the bees are rushing to this big fancy individual and just visiting its flowers, and the individual would actually disappear from the gene pool. So I think there would be a problem in plants to start trying to outcompete one another. You want to make sure you're one of hundreds of individual plants that the bee, when she's foraging, will visit one after another. And bees are incredibly faithful. They come out of the hive, for example, if it's the honeybee, and the first plant she visits, if it's got nectar, she will say, right, I'm going to stick to the buttercups. And that entire flight that she makes from the hive, she would just visit buttercup flowers, or she would just visit clover flowers. And we also know that they then communicate that back in the hive to other individuals, saying, I found a great patch of clover 150 yards to the southeast.
Yeah, there's another scenario, Matthew, as well. And this is the case of orchids. Now, we have the bee orchid in Ireland, which resembles a bee. And the received wisdom is that a bee is fooled by this, tries to mate with it, discovers that it is not in actual fact another bee, and goes off and tries it again on another one, thus bringing the pollen with it. Whereas in actual fact, these bee orchids are in fact sterile and they self-pollinate themselves. So did they do this once and not do it any longer because the bees weren't doing it? Or why are they like that if we're going to be going with it? Why do they look like bees and be self-fertilising?
It is one of the sort of inexplicable things that the bee orchid seems to have spread further than the species of wasp that relied on, this little solitary wasp that's fooled into actually copulating with the flower. And it was one of the inexplicable things is how sometimes a species gets away from its pollinator like that. And like you say, in a bee orchid, if you look at them in the field in Ireland, the little pollinia drop down and the wind literally blows them against the stigma, and lo and behold, it will be able to set seed. So it is one of these oddities. And we mustn't expect nature to be sort of perfectly functioning everywhere. And when it doesn't function and we can see that there's a problem, it is fascinating to then understand that it works. And in the case of the bee orchid, it doesn't matter that it's self-fertilizing itself. Clearly, it works sufficiently for the bee orchids to always be around us. I mean, Darwin realized that if you outbred foxgloves, they were much more robust and strong individuals. And if they were inbred, pollinated by their own pollen, the individuals were much weaker and produced a smaller crop of flowers. So we know that inbreeding is bad in plants and in animals. But if it means a difference between surviving or not surviving, in the case of the bee orchid, it ensures that it survives.
Is that true of, say, wasp orchids and fly orchids? There's a whole load of these, and they're very interesting to look at. Presumably, at some time in the past, they did need these pollinators to come and copulate with them, as you describe. Is this a kind of residual organ or function that is like our appendix, for instance? It's said to be of no function whatever in the stomach. Now, is it like that, something that's left behind? It was needed long ago, eons ago, but it has fallen into disuse. Is that how we should picture these particular creatures?
Well, the really beautiful sort of story behind that is we used to think there were sort of 40 to 50 species of fly orchid and bee orchid. This is the genus Ophrys, which occurs all across Europe. But when they looked at them genetically, they looked at their genes to try and work out how they'd all evolved, they realised actually there are only about a dozen species, just 12 species across Europe, but some of them were very varied. So when they found themselves in Crete, for example, there was a different wasp or bee, so they adjusted their flowers. So the flowers look slightly different, but actually they are all of the same genetic lineage. So there was a case where us human beings were looking at the differences and we said, oh yes, that is definitely different. But in terms of the biology, it appears that evolution still hasn't caught up. They are being pollinated by different species of wasp and bee around Europe, but they have not genetically diverged yet. So the question is, are those species because us humans can spot the difference, or are they not species because genetically they still haven't turned into anything different from their sort of great-great-great-grandparents? So it's a fascinating glimpse of a world where we know the world is full of species, but trying to define what a species is has foxed biologists sort of ever since Charles Darwin first made his great insights into the origin of species. We still can't define a species simply.
I'm amazed by the amount of knowledge that you all have there. It's fantastic. I'm learning a lot. I did have another point that maybe we could address. It's on the same topic. By being identifiable and recognizable to insects and to people, plants are setting themselves up to be food plants for these species as well. So, you have butterflies that feed on plants. you have humans who feed on plants. Could there be an advantage in that respect in being recognisable, in the sense that, you know, would that help to spread a species, you know, by the foragers, the human foragers, say, collecting them and taking them away? Would that be an advantage to the plant?
One of the beautiful answers to that is, for example, that wheat was a chance hybrid on the shores of the Black Sea maybe 9,000 years ago, and almost certainly a Neolithic woman passing by said, that's going to be handy to feed my children, these grains, I can grind them up and feed my child. She probably started to take some home, grow them on a little plot near the village, and suddenly wheat was domesticated and now covers, every year us humans grow between 30 and 40 times the area of Ireland in wheat, whose origin was just a chance hybrid plant on the shores of the Black Sea. And likewise, the apple tree, the apple is now grown all over the Northern Hemisphere in New Zealand, South America, South Africa. And yet the apple itself just comes from a tiny little area of the Tian Shan Mountains in Kazakhstan. So our desire for food plants, drug plants, medicinal plants, has been an enormous evolutionary advantage to those things that we have picked, if you like, out of the wild and brought them into cultivation. They now have this evolutionary advantage of suddenly being favoured by Homo sapiens and given them a gigantic evolutionary advantage.
On the other hand, what about the llama's growth on the oak? Oak trees do not like having their leaves eaten by caterpillars and actually secrete toxins into the leaves to make them not palatable. And this is in fact what happens. And we have this llama's growth coming on oak trees in August because the toxins in them protect the leaves from being eaten by insects. And there are those who say, speaking of wheat, that the wheat doesn't like it either. And wheat has evolved to such an extent that many people find modern varieties of wheat unable to digest it because of gluten levels and the like, and they're going back to these earlier species like spelt and the like, that the plants can fight back if they don't want to be eaten. So it's not all hunky-dory, it's a great thing and they're loving it. Some of them are hating it.
There you go, Colleen.
Yeah, well, it's great. I never imagined that there'd be so many ideas out there. Are you familiar with a vegetable called the Romanesco cauliflower? There's a greengrocer's near me, Robbie's Greengrocer's, and sometimes he has this cauliflower. It's called Romanesco cauliflower. And unlike the ordinary cauliflower, the edible bit of it is a very strange geometrical shape. It's just astonishing to look at. So it kind of brings me back to my original question, why on earth would a cauliflower have this extraordinary geometrical shape, you know? It's mind-boggling, really.
The way that plants grow has also got this a beautiful pattern to it. When you are, as a plant stem, you're packing all your new leaves or petals or buds inside a big bud, the best packing ratios conform to a particular series called the Fibonacci series. And that Fibonacci series is literally the last two digits added together. So 1 plus 1 is 2, 2 plus 1 is 3, 3 plus 2 is 5, 5 plus 3 is 8, 8 plus 5 is 13. Those ratios are absolutely fixed in the plant world. And it's a beautiful insight that the spirals on a pine cone or the little scales of a pineapple fruit, they all conform to this pattern. And what you're seeing in that Romanesco cauliflower head is this almost fractal-like beauty of this Fibonacci series in every little bud that this huge flower head of the cauliflower represents. So, yes, when it's presented in a particular way and would have been selected. That cultivar was selected because of its good looks. It just looks beautiful. That is simply an expression of the Fibonacci series. There's nothing magical about it. It's the best way to pack your three petals or five petals or eight petals into a bud.
Well, Matthew, thank you very much indeed. And Colleen, thank you for starting that wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. No problem.